For over half a century, London W12 7RJ Wood Lane became the spiritual home of British television. Designed by the architect Graham Dawbarn, this was the UK's first purpose-built TV hub with the cutting-edge camera technology, 8 bespoke studios, production galleries, and the now legendary BBC bar. Well, for many, BBC Television Centre came to represent the magic and glamour of British entertainment, light entertainment, glossy, glamorous shows, and hosted everything from Auntie's New Bloomers to Z Cars behind those famous double doors. To mark 10 years since the closure of Britain's most famous television studios, Beyond the Title welcomes some of the BBC's best-loved faces to remember and celebrate the history and legacy of TV's first dream factory. So, join Josh and the team as they remember BBC Television Centre.
Legendary writer and broadcaster Michael Aspel joined the BBC in 1957 as a newsreader and continuity announcer based in the corporation's Cardiff headquarters before starring in BBC Children's Hour serial Counter Spy. By the early 60s, he was one of the leading newsreaders in Britain and found his home at the Limegrove Studios to record announcements about programmes while TV Centre was still being built. In 1968, he replaced Eamon Andrews, not for the last time, as the host of the popular children's series Crackerjack for 6 years, live from TV Centre, alongside Don McLean, Elaine Page and Little and Large. Move to LWT in 1984 resulted in the early evening chat show Aspel & Company, which featured some of the world's biggest names in entertainment. This made him the perfect candidate to inherit Eamon Andrews' famous Big Red Book in 1988, and for 15 years, Aspel became synonymous with the four words which brought a tear to many and to unsuspecting celebrities as he said those immortal words, "This is your life." I caught up with a TV icon as part of Beyond the Title's TV Centre season. Ladies and gentlemen, Michael Aspel.
So joining the BBC before the opening of TV Centre, you worked as a newsreader and continuity announcer, first in the Cardiff headquarters and in Lime Grove. In this modern age, on-screen continuity announcers are resigned to television history, but just give us a brief description of the role of a CA and how significant they were to the running of a network.
Well, first of all, I was a radio actor for a couple of years, and then I became, as you say, an announcer back up at Lime Grove, and the announcers then were in vision. That's the extraordinary thing. We wore a communal dinner jacket. There was just one. It was huge, but no one saw your legs, so it was okay. And we had to keep the network going, and we popped up in between almost every programme, all in black and white, of course. And we were useful, but we were told to keep our place in the order of things. It was all surnames in those days. You weren't Michael or Mike, you were Aspel. And I remember once I had to go on and advertise Radio Times, the magazine, and I said, I gave the price at sixpence, but it was only actually tuppence. They said, "You better get back in there and Aspel and correct it." So I went back in and I said, "You know, that's what the..." Mind you, I said and winked, "It's worth a tanner." And I went back up and they said, "That's how to lose your profession, you'll lose your job. You can't do that." No, you weren't meant to be a human being. You were just meant to be a cipher in the whole process.
So throughout the 1950s, rumours began circulating surrounding the erection of Britain's first purpose-built television studios. What were the thoughts amongst the broadcasting community about this mammoth purpose-built centre, and what was the attitude of other areas of the corporation to the new medium of television entertainment?
Well, there was a surprising amount of anti-feeling about that. A lot of people thought they couldn't possibly afford it, apart from anything else. I was never privy to any of these points of view, of course. I was just on the soldiering end of the whole business. I don't think I have any more to say about that. I can talk about when I first went up there, what state it was in, but the political side of it really isn't much for me to contribute to.
So in 1968, you joined the team on Crackerjack. In your opinion, how was children's television able to use the medium and TV centre to its fullest potential in order to maximise the shared viewing experience?
Well, it was certainly one of the most popular shows. Children's television and children's radio, especially when I was a kid, were very important. And they were on every day, and everyone adored them, all the children and some of the adults. And television for children was also very popular, with Muffin the Mule and all the rest of it. And then things got more sophisticated, if you would pardon me using that phrase, in terms of crackerjack. And it became part of the nation's language. The sort of thing where you go down the road and a taxi driver would lean out and shout, "Crackerjack!" You know, "It's 5 for 5 and it's crackerjack!" So, it was very much a part of the thing, which it doesn't seem to be anymore. It's kind of gone into its little niche and ticks away quietly, but it wasn't a sort of whole family experience.
Beyond current affairs and children's TV, in 1977, you contributed to a piece of TV history when you starred in the now legendary Morecambe and Wise sketch alongside many BBC presenters in a tribute to Rodger and Hammerstein's There's Nothing Like a Dame from the South Pacific. In what ways did this experience make you realise Eric and Ernie's vision of using the medium of television to its very fullest? And in what ways did TV Centre offer Morecambe and Wise a creative hub in which to cultivate their unique talents?
Well, certainly they did move around between channels and did find their home there. That particular show, oddly enough, Eric was against doing that item. He didn't think it was going to work. Obviously, that we, non-performers, were going to make a mess of it and therefore reduce the show. But instead of which, of course, it worked superbly because the man who was the producer of the programme was an old dancer and he knew what would look visually good. And the idea of Richard Baker, this sedate newsreader, chum of mine, doing a triple somersault when we played cricket, he can only bowl underhand, so it wasn't typical of him. And it just worked wonderfully well, and Eric was absolutely thrilled with the whole thing. And they became, as we all know, part of the nation's top of the list loved ones. Oddly enough, I did a programme with them years before that, when I was working at Alexandra Palace and just become a freelance in 1968. And I was invited to go on their show just to do a song and dance routine, a comedy routine. And it was terrific. And what was so good about them was the fact that I kind of ad-libbed some physical stuff, which was a terrible cheek. No, civilian ever does that to professional entertainers. But I did it, and the audience laughed, and Eric and Ernie were pleased, which was such a relief. And I became not close friends, but sort of buddies with them. They realised we all shared a laugh, and it was a happy time.
So how do you think that changed the landscape of entertainment? Because newsreaders would never usually cross the border into light entertainment.
The idea of getting that gang of broadcasters together to do the comedy routine was hardly original, to say the least. And it did show people that, we could step outside the actual discipline that we were tied to professionally. And it loosened the whole business up. And it was Eric and Ernie who did that. And Eric sort of reluctantly, but it worked. And it did, people still talk about it.
It's interesting that yours and Eamon Andrews' careers arguably ran in parallel. What do you think were the similarities and differences between your presenting styles?
I think the difference between Eamon and me was he was a little more serious than I was. I've always been rather sort of silly. And he enjoyed a joke, but he got very worked up and nervous about things. Now, nervousness is a very healthy thing, but he was... I did a few surprises with him before I got involved with the show. And I watched him closely and he perspired and was terribly sort of nervous about the thing because it was really his show. And so when I took over from him, I had the main problem was how am I going to say those words without sounding like him? I was going to say, "This is your life." Mm-hmm. I thought, I can't. So I just walk up and down the dressing room saying, "This is your life," in various ways. And people, of course, when you take over from someone who is a much-loved, established personality with that particular programme, many are going to not enjoy it, and you're going to get stick from reviewers, etc. But thank God it worked. And what we had in common, I think, was the ability to stand back and not intrude too much on the other people told the story, which is really what I've done most of my life. Eamon was a great sportsman. He was a boxer, as you may know. He was Golden Gloves of Ireland, I believe. And he once told me was doing the commentary on an evening of boxing, and he was in one of the bouts himself. And I said, "What did you do? How did you commentate on that?" "Oh, he's coming at me now. Oh, he's hit me in the chops."
Another figure who became not only your contemporary but also your doppelganger was Michael Parkinson. In hindsight, what effect did this have on your career?
Interesting that Michael Parkinson, of course, is a journalist. That's his main and has always been his main profession. And he got into broadcasting, and he did what is a very good idea, was to do one programme, which was an enormous success, and put his name into the sort of history books. And that's what people, when they talk about chat shows, they always say, Parkinson. That's what he did. He did it very well, got all the big stars, and I had no opposition. He didn't go into other programmes. He kept at that. And that kept him in good stead, because the danger of things the way I have, you know, had my working life, is a bit like Roy Castle, the old entertainer. He did too much. He was funny, he could tap dance, he could sing, and he did all those things, but he should have just done one, really, yeah. And people would have, you know, loved him for that. In the same way that I have done so many programmes that people can't quite place me, and they just know that was the guy who was on telly. I did the chat show as well, but although I didn't enjoy it as much as I thought, I always felt this is really coming second to the person that everyone regards as being Mr. Chacho.
And your connection with Parkinson would continue, because he obviously took over from you for the panel show Give Us a Clue. How difficult is it to preside over two teams of highly entertaining people and maintain your composure in order to steer the show in the right direction?
Well, one thing, I don't ever mind losing my composure. I mean, I think when things are either difficult or tricky or something, you know, too funny for you to cap or whatever, then the inspiration comes from somewhere. And I found that programme a little frustrating to do, because I was simply the bloke who handed out the cards to the people, and I wanted to get out there and do it myself. It was, after all, just an old parlour game that families did for centuries past. And I remember on one occasion, one of the members of the public that we used to have on the teams came up and did the most bizarre routine. And I realised what had happened. He hadn't turned the card over, and he was miming his own name. So that was tricky. But it was a very lovely kind of family show. Lionel Blair and Eunice Stubbs. And we were great pals. And Michael came along, but he's not a light entertainment man. And he did the show and did it professionally as a presenter, but I don't think he yearned to get out there quite as much as I did.
In 1984, the links with you and Parky kept coming when you secured your own LWT chat show, Aspel & Company. What made this show distinctively different from its contemporaries, Wogan, Des O'Connor Tonight and Parkinson?
I don't think Aspel & Company was different enough from what had gone before. It was pretty standard chat show stuff. I tried to... everyone tries to get their own personality into it a little bit. One thing that made me uncomfortable about my own chat shows is that I'd been on Capital Radio in London for 10 years and had done my own homework on every guest that I was going to interview, and so knew more about them than they did themselves by the time they came on, and you were able to back that up. On television it was different, because they would have their own team of people coming along and saying what they wished to be asked, our own team suggesting what we would like to ask, and then I had this television set from the producer telling me in the middle of the interview what I should ask next. So it was an entirely and not an entirely comfortable experience. Sometimes it worked wonderfully well, and people still talk about occasional episodes. But after the 10 years on radio, where it became, you know, a go-to kind of place for interviews, this didn't really work as well as I hoped.
TC1 at TV Centre has often been compared to the enormity and prestige of stepping out on stage at the London Palladium. How do you think TV Centre was able to offer the BBC its own hallowed territory, which became a rite of passage for any performer?
Yes, TV Centre really became, because it looked so magnificent as well, it became the place to go to for all the top entertainers and all the top shows. There were people, of course, in the BBC who thought it was a tremendous waste of money, and in the end, of course, it did become something that needed to be sold for the whole place to keep going.
In order to develop such a creative hotbed of talent, which TV Centre thrived upon, there was a whole generation of pioneering management who had the vision to create such a defining era of TV. How integral were people like Bill Cotton, Hugh Carlton Green, David Attenborough and co. to the development and presentation of the values which TV Centre stood for?
The names you've just mentioned, they are the men who did it. I mean, extraordinary. Bill Cotton was a huge influence on the light entertainment scene and a very approachable man, as most of them were, which is not always the case. People no longer called you by your surname, so it was a much friendlier business. And they they changed the face of television broadcasting, or helped it to develop. I have one sad memory of the Television Centre. There was one evening when there was an award ceremony going on in London, and it was being compared by Kenneth Horne, the lovely urbane host of Round the Horn and other radio programmes, much loved character, and a very pleasant man as well. And I was sitting in my dinner suit in Television Centre, ostensibly at the awards, so that I could present an edited version at the end of the evening. And as we watched from the studio, this tiny studio in the Television Centre, he fell off the dais. Kenneth Horne fell off and died. And no one said he had died, but he did die at that point. And I then had the job of coming on at the end of the evening, because they didn't cancel the programme, and say, you know, it was a lovely evening except for one thing. I had to find a way of doing that.
Yeah.
And that's when I said that when things are live and you think more quickly and you're able to do things. And so I said what I thought was appropriate when the time came. And the next day I was walking along the Television Centre corridors, and skidding round the corner came David Attenborough, who was then head of BBC Two, and he just tapped me on the shoulder, so I knew I'd done all right.
How did the show carry on? How did it finish? Because if the host had passed away, what happened to the rest of the procession?
Yes, that's true. It must have been fairly near the end. But they, yes, I presented it as a complete item. So that's a silly, very good question. But of course, they didn't know he had died, but nevertheless, the show had to go on.
Yeah, it carried on as. Speaking of Bill Cotton, you presented him with the Big Red Book in March 1995. Such a formidable figure of the BBC, in what way did this show offer the BBC the opportunity to celebrate itself along with paying tribute to a legend?
Well, it was unusual for the Life to celebrate people who were, it was like one of the family. We didn't do that. We didn't inspect ourselves. But I think it did a bit of good. Luckily, Bill Cotton and his father, Billy Cotton, they were down-to-earth people, very approachable and very much, very well able to understand the needs of the public. And it was a valuable bit of PR for him and for the show, and nice for the public to see, you know, an executive being a real person.
One of the most striking things I've observed from researching TV in the 60s and 70s was the ease in which performers collaborated. To what extent was this made possible by the locality and creativity of TV Centre?
One of the great things about the Television Centre was that it brought shows of all shades of entertainment and the rest of it together, and a good place to meet in the BBC Club, which was one of the most important parts of the establishment. You'd always see people huddled together, either discussing the boat race or planning a new programme. But it was valuable. It was also quite funny, because the people used to tease the commissionaire, who used to make announcements on the microphone, and he was quite naive, this particular bloke, and just did what people asked him to announce. And I was there one night when this voice came on and said, "Would the cast of the Wooden Tops return to the studio, please?" Well, imagine that. And he asked once, "Would Miss Jenny Taylor please come to the phone?" And so we go to a terrible line.
So despite having a long association with the corporation, your career also offered you insight into the workings of commercial television. Looking back now, what did TV Centre offer the corporation which other networks couldn't emulate?
The Television Centre was the centre of television almost in the world. It was the most famous building in the world in terms of broadcasting. And people, once they broadcast there, they felt they had made it. I mean, television went on in other excellent spots as well. And when Thames Television, LWT, came along in the London area, they were equally respected and people were desperate to work there too. But it's like the sort of Buckingham Palace of broadcasting.
Yeah. In 1982, you swapped sides to front the 6 o'clock show alongside Danny Baker and Emma Freud, broadcast live from Studio 3 of the London studios. Looking at this now, it seemed ahead of its time. But how does the geographic layout of a TV studio affect the overall quality of a programme?
When I went to the 6 o'clock show at LWT with Danny Baker and I had to make a choice between that and the Give Us a Clue programme, because they were different companies and they didn't share people in those days. It was very difficult to work for more than one. And so I decided it would be time to move on and do this. And live was a challenge and always fun. And Danny Baker was this marvellous person to work with, because some viewers got in touch and said he was loud and vulgar and uneducated. Absolutely wrong. He was one of the cleverest and brightest people I ever worked with, fluent and inventive and the rest of it. And it became, as a very, a local programme in terms of what goes on around the country, no one outside London saw it. It became a sort of landmark of the week's television down here. Friday night welcomed the weekend. There was that kind of feel about it, and the fact that it was live and we could move around the studio. I did have upset one of my colleagues once, and he was Andy Price, and he was a sort of roving reporter on the show. And he did a report one Friday evening for one of those exhibitions in London at one of the big halls. And it was obviously a sporting one, because he appeared wearing bathing trunks. And he was a plump little man. And he did his pieces. And I said, "Thank you very much." And I said, as I turned away from the camera, I said, "That reminds me, I must get some pork sausages on the way home." Which upset his mother very much. But we were all pals. And that was the other thing. You became a team in a way that you didn't any other time. Because you had to, if you underrun, you had to know that your team would be able to fill the time and it wouldn't seem like you were counting the clock. That can, of course, be a disadvantage, because on one Friday evening, filling up, I asked Danny and the others what they were doing for the weekend, and I heard myself saying, "We're going down to Eastbourne." And when I got back from Eastbourne, I'd been burgled. The house had been gutted.
Oh, my God. So, in 1988, you would replace Eamon Andrews for the second time and inherit the famous Big Red Book and uttered the immortal words, "This is your life." How do you think the show changed the concept of celebrity at a time before celebrity magazines and social media?
I suppose the big difference between This Is Your Life and magazines is that This Is Your Life, the facts come from the people involved, and rather than the journalists making up what they wanted to, which they always seem to do. And it became a much loved, and some people hated it, of course. It was an American idea, the programme, and ran for there for some years and then came here. And the interesting thing is that although we used to look for celebrities and get their private lives, there was one occasion when the producer would be given money to get 23 programmes, and he would spend it how he liked, just to give us 23 programmes. And we finished in Hollywood doing Charlton Heston and ran out of money. So we came back with one show to do. And someone said, well, there's this milkman in Epping who's just got the MBE for being a nice bloke. So we went down to Epping and I hid behind the fence as this milk float came along, said, this is your life. And he looked surprised. And he was a very nice bloke. But that was it. People came on and said, oh, he's nice. He's a nice man. Then the local football team came on and said, oh, he's a very nice man. And that was it, really. But when the viewing figures came through, he got more viewers than Charlton Heston.
Wow. Incredible.
And that shows you, how much people wanted to know, not just about the celebrities, but about other people.
Yeah, just normal people.
Of course, in terms of the subjects of This Is Your Life, you could only go through their loved ones who would tell you whether they thought they would like it or whether they would rather die. So we always knew what we were in for, or assumed so. What we didn't assume was that the person didn't know what we were talking about. And that happened to me when I had to surprise the oldest lifeboatman in Britain on his boat. And I was lowered by helicopter onto the heaving deck of this boat. And there was this ancient guy at the wheel. And I struggled up towards him, gasping with the red book, said, Charlie Funn, it's your life. And he didn't take his eyes off the wheel. He said, oh, yeah. And that was it. And that's all he said to the entire programme. But it was a good show, of course.
What do you mean, rejected it?
Straight? Oh, anybody said no?
Yeah, anyone that rejected it straight away? Or?
As far as the surprise of the guest is concerned, there was a story about Eamon Andrews and this footballer called, I can't think of his name, famous footballer, and he said no. But then he told Eamon that he would say no if he ever did him. So they luckily had a standby programme and it was okay. But you're always prepared for someone to say no, even though their loved ones have given you the nod. But there was one occasion when we went down to do Bill Oddie's life down at the Eden Project. He was down there doing something there. And I went down to him and I'd met him a few times. I'd done the goodies a couple of times. And I said, no, Bill, you're like, no, I didn't, no. And he would not do it. I said, well, come anyway, there'll be a party, lots of people you know. Yeah, I like people I don't like, no, thank you. Anyway, he said, okay. We got back in the car to come back to London, and the phone rang in the car, and the producer answered it. And it was Bill Oddie's family who said that they had said to him, if you don't do this, we're going to kill you, because they'd been through so much getting all the facts together and... Yeah. And all that. And he did it. You saw that his heart really wasn't in it, though.
Did you have any guests that ever thought they knew what they were in store for?
Knew in advance?
Yeah, knew in advance, or thought they knew. But then you did end up getting them on a few things and surprising them.
Yes, one of the things about This Is Your Life was that it ruined your social life, because you would go into a gathering and everyone would cringe, because they thought you might be coming for them, and especially well-known people. Some of them looked a bit disappointed when you went home afterwards. But there was one occasion when Des O'Connor went to Thames Television to do a rehearsal for one of the shows he was doing, and he he saw a bus go by with all his family in it as he was going into the studios, and he thought, I'm going insane, absolutely insane. But it never occurred to him that there might be anything about to happen.
Yeah.
He thought he'd just made a mistake. So later that night, you know, as he finished rehearsals, up came Eamon and the rest of the family, and that sort of made him realise he wasn't mad.
Yeah.
But in America, I think a lot of the American people we surprised knew there was something about their response that was a bit artificial.
Yeah.
But there's nothing you could do about it. If you wanted an international superstar, you're going to have to play that kind of game. It was never admitted. No one ever told me I knew, and I never asked them. But you could tell.
Yeah.
But it was fun all the same. Mm. I mean, I think, and the great thing was, for me, I used to meet interesting people. But when we did someone like Bob Hope, who was then in his 90s. And all these old American entertainers used to come on. The people I had seen as a child, who were now desperately old, and they came on, and you could imagine, and they did their number. And they were as they had always been. And you could imagine that they had been, as they were, sort of tarted up before they came on. And then you got the impression that when they went off, they were kind of dismantled and put away in a little box. And you've been privy to a wonderful rejuvenation.
Yeah.
It's great. And the other thrill, of course, was the fact that I've been beamed up with William Shatner. Or was I beamed down? Didn't hurt, anyway. But not many people can claim to have been beamed
up. No, that's good.
Oh, yeah.
There's something that Josh has always wanted to ask you. So when you actually opened the Red Book, what was actually inside?
The script of the programme was inside when I opened the book. Every word that I uttered, apart from the ad-libs that developed during the show, which one always looked for. And the problem about that was when you had some unexpected developments and lots of fun, you would enjoy it. But the programme was only 29 minutes long and had to be edited, and all that disappeared, so it seemed rather strange. So the less ad-lib fun you had, the better. But yes, the book was simply the words, and that is the book that I handed over, as you may have seen, to the subject. Never victim, always the subject. later we tarted this all up and filled it with photographs and even a little disc of the recording. And that was presented to them in a beautiful leather, well, at the same book, actually.
Yep.
It was leather and gold and all that.
So Bob Monkhouse ended up with two Red Books. What made him such a worthy subject?
Yes, there were a few people who got a second helping. It was, I suppose, because when they, in Desi's case, he was always much loved by the kind of audience that particularly liked This Is Your Life. And he would have been fairly young, I suppose, the first time around. And the second time, of course, his career had progressed and gone on, and he was almost, developed into almost somebody else. So that was why he was worth the second go. And I'm sure it worked very well.
In January 2000, you took to TV Centre to present A Night of a Thousand Lives, celebrating the long-running series. How do you think this epitomised the enormous appetite to delve deeper into the careers of our best love stars?
Yes, when we did The Night of a Thousand Stars, it was revelatory, you know, to see all those people, many of whom, of course, had been featured long before I joined the show. And it was fascinating, but you felt once again that you were only to kind of touch the surface of all these lives, and that some of them had revealed bits in their stories that you wish you'd had time to develop. And you looked around and thought, there's a thousand more shows out there telling, you know, what's happened since, but more meaty in a way. Because a lot of the witnesses who came on shows were, it was a bit phony at times. We did the life of the man, Desmond Llewellyn, who played M. No, he was Q, in the James Bond films. And he was a lovely man, slightly irascible, but very likeable. And on came an actor, an old actor, who said, I remember we were young actors together. We went by train up to Scotland, and on the way, we saw these two gals sitting in a compartment. We said, care if we join you? And we had a lovely time all the way to Scotland. And that was this anecdote. And Desmond Llewellyn got up and said, that's an absolute load of bollocks. And the man just sort of smiled weakly, and I think it might have been excised from the show. Because there was a bit of rude language from time to time. Yeah. There was one actor from a soap we did, and he was in a hospital, a children's ward, and we surprised him, and he was so shocked that he let out a stream of foul language. And all the children shrank, and the mothers covered the children's ears up, and we said, I think we'll take that again.
So, as a broadcaster, in what ways did TV Centre make it easier for you to shine?
TV Centre made me feel that I was, in my own way, a star. You felt if you're going to the television centre, you cannot go into a more prestigious building in the world of broadcasting. Therefore, if you're part of it, you must be slightly worthwhile as well. That was what I got from that. And, of course, that you would be remembered by the people on the door. They wouldn't just think you were a taxi driver bringing someone else's clothes in, which has happened once or twice. But it was prestigious. It was lovely. And there were facilities for celebrating afterwards, which were much appreciated as well. And then you would mingle, get to know people a lot better than when you worked with them.
And just to finish off, what's the legacy of TV Centre?
The legacy of TV Centre is that it's always somewhere like Alexandra Palace that people can look back on the history of broadcasting and say that was a huge landmark. It is, as we all know, still slightly in use. There are a couple of smaller studios that are used, but the former glory has gone, and it's very sad to think that it's now nice apartments, although, good luck to them. But it's, I'm sure there are ghosts there. If there's not, then there should be, because huge experiences and huge shows came out of that place, and we'd always be grateful for that.